From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday when State Attorney General Letitia James announced the grand jury's decision in the case surrounding the death of Daniel Prude. RPD officers found Prude nude and in distress during the early morning hours of March 23rd last year. During the interaction, police restrained Prude and put a spit hood over his head. He died a week later in the hospital after the interaction, including officers who put their full body weight on his head against the pavement. The medical examiner ruled the death a homicide. Yesterday, just a few blocks from where the incident occurred, Attorney General Tish James announced that none of the officers involved in Prude's death would face criminal charges. The grand jury declined to indict them. The attorney general said, quote, "I am disappointed, extremely disappointed. Unfortunately, historically, if one analyzes the intersection of the criminal justice system and race, one recognizes the influence of race," end quote. During her remarks, James announced a series of recommendations for police reform. Well, last night, hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Rochester. Protest leaders vowed to hold more demonstrations in the coming days and to push for the reforms they have been calling for months now. This hour, as the national spotlight is again on Rochester, we discuss the results of the grand jury's investigation, the reaction among the community, and what our guests might wish to see next in terms of reforms. And I will welcome them now. Natalie Ann Knott is an assistant public defender. Natalie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Danielle Ponder is a musician and attorney. Danielle, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan.
Natalie, was there any surprise at the results announced yesterday?
Yes and no. I mean, that's always a complicated question because as a Black person, you want to hope that your life means something in the criminal justice system. You want to hope that after all of the protests and all of the conversations and of all of the books and, you know, all of the thoughts and prayers that it would have made a difference. And it never does. And so there's something really shocking about never being shocked by this. And I think that just adds to the trauma that it seems like, you know, as a movement and as a people, we're screaming into the void and no one is listening. Nothing is changing. So, yes and no is the answer.
Okay. What about you, Danielle Ponder?
You know, I was holding out. I had like a little bit of hope in me. Like even as I was hearing it was going to be no build, I'm like, maybe people are getting it wrong. Maybe it's not right. But yeah, I can't say I was surprised, but I just, you know, Evan, honestly, I just am experiencing a deep sorrow and a mourning. I don't even have any rage left in me. I just feel extremely sad, not only about this decision, but just thinking about all of this in a historical context, how many Black men and women have been murdered and no one has been held to account. I mean, since the time the Africans set foot on this country. And that is what I keep thinking about, the lynchings that happened, the police murders. I mean, just Black bodies constantly being devalued. And it's just been weighing on my heart heavy in the past few hours.
Yeah, and so, Danielle, I think it's important to recognize that everyone's experience is a little different. People who work in activism or work for reform may have different emotions and sentiment, but what you are expressing sounds to me like an exasperation. So instead of feeling sort of charged up and ready to sort of fight for more reforms, I have to admit that having known you the way I do, you sound a little defeated at this moment. Are you feeling that it's temporary, or are you worried about, you know, sort of the weeks and months to come and maybe losing some steam toward the change that you had hoped to see?
I think it has to be temporary because I think about my father, who was a sharecropper, and the things that he witnessed, actually knowing people who were lynched, and the fact that he got up the next morning and he still made a way for his family, or, you know, my great-grandmother who was hung. I think of those people who still, her family still got up the next day. So I have to have that strength to keep going forward. But right now, I'm after the verdict, I went to my father's house and we played guitar, we sang songs. And that's what I needed in the moment. I couldn't even really go to the march. I really couldn't go to the rally. I kind of drove around and talked to a few people, but, you know, I just feel a deep grief. And I, right now, my energy is so low because I'm so tired. And I'm so tired. And Evan, I've been doing this for a long time. Like, I've been doing activism work, criminal justice reform work, talking about police stops when Duffy was mayor. I mean, years of doing this work. And I still have to look white people in the face and try to explain to them why we should have value, why our lives should be valued. And I'm just so sick of it. I'm so tired, but I know I can't. There's no other, giving up is just not an option. But resting at this moment is kind of where my mind is.
How do you feel, Natalie?
I think Danielle hit the nail on the head in a lot of ways. Exhausted. I mean, this is like asking a patient in the ICU to fix themselves, to get up out of, you know, their coma or when they're incredibly ill and continue to treat themselves. It's exhausting, and it's more than any person or people should ever have to do, but we don't have a choice. So we will continue, but we need, sometimes you just need to for lack of a better term, feel your feelings and not keep pushing the trauma down. Because that's what kills Black people faster than every other, you know, racial demographic in the United States. The high blood pressure, the heart disease, the cancer. This all comes out of this repeated trauma that we just internalize, and often we don't give ourselves time to process and feel it. We just keep fighting forward. That's what, you know, that's what Ashley's doing right now. She's still pushing through this. And that's an incredible burden. And it's an incredible, it puts us at physical risk, and it's just exhausting. So like Danielle, I am also trying to be kind to myself and be gentle to myself and, you know, and feel what's going on now, but we'll be back because we have no choice. I mean, these are literally our lives and the lives of the people we love on the line. We don't have a choice but to get back in the fight. But, you know, this was a really serious blow, not just into the Rochester community, but to Black people all over the United States. Once again, it happened again, and it keeps happening. And it was on video, and the whole world saw. And it happened again, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you, Natalie. What I do want to direct the conversation about, I mean, I certainly understand the emotion, the sentiment of the moment, feeling like nothing can be done. But looking forward, I think both of our guests today in this hour are really well positioned to not only talk about reforms and their views on change, but also from their legal expertise. They're both attorneys, and there's a lot they understand much more sort of intricately than I do when you try to analyze, for example, what the AG said, how you present a case, you know, everything that goes into what led to a grand jury making its decision yesterday. So I want to ask both of you about what AG James said. She said that she was deeply disappointed that this wasn't the outcome that she wanted, and that she wanted to be as transparent as she could in letting the community know about the case that her office made. She said they made the strongest case they could make to pursue charges against the Rochester officers, and ultimately a grand jury decided not to charge. Now, the attorney general did not answer other questions that I think were important. For example, she said there's going to be more specifics on reforms to come. She talked a little bit about that, but there's more that I think the community needs to hear about what might reform a system that seems resistant to change. She also did not talk about what her office discovered regarding city leadership. She promised months back that she would get to the bottom of whether there was a cover-up either in the police department or city leadership. She decided not to comment on that yesterday. So there's a lot we don't know here. And Natalie, I'll start with you. Were you impressed, and at least did you feel that the Attorney General do you trust that she made the strongest case that she could have made? Let's start there.
Well, I'm going to take the Attorney General at her word until we are able to review the grand jury minutes and find out exactly what happened in that courtroom. But I will say that even if the AG's office did put on the strongest case possible, when it comes to holding police accountable, even law enforcement, even the Attorney General's office is playing against a stacked deck. We have created so many protections, both institutional and legal, for police that they can use mm-hmm. to avoid accountability, that even with a cut and dry video, we still were able to come out with this outcome. And that is because we have completely ensconced the police departments everywhere, and we have protected them. We've wrapped them around all of these protections to avoid accountability, from qualified immunity to, fear for my life. Oh, my goodness. Excited delirium is even one of them, a label they can slap on people as a justification to brutalize them. And we just all consider that fine. And we've done this forever. And we can't even stop there with the legal protections police have. We have created, the entire media has created this idea in people's minds that police are always the good guys. They're always above reproach. Think of all the Law and Order. Think of all the CSI. Mm-hmm. All of these things. We have created this idea that police are infallible, white knights coming to save us all. And that's simply not the truth. And so when you're trying to find a jury of people, you're not going to be able to find a jury of Americans who have received a balanced notion from the media and from their daily lives and, from pop culture of what policing is actually like and what police are actually like. So even if the Attorney General's office did everything right and presented the strongest case possible, they are still already playing against the stacked deck when it comes to police.
Let me get Danielle on this, and Maria in Rochester on the phone. We'll come to you in just a moment here. I want to just let listeners know, you heard Natalie mention qualified immunity. Next hour, our conversation is all about qualified immunity because the Monroe County Bar Association has been putting together plans for a public panel online tomorrow night on the subject of law enforcement and legal immunity. That was before anyone knew that we were going to get these results this week. So that's next hour, and we will talk a lot more about qualified immunity. We're also going to talk more this hour about excited delirium. You heard Natalie just mention that. That came up in the AG's report yesterday. And we got a lot more on that coming up in just a moment there. But Daniel Ponder, what did you make of what you saw from the AG? Were you satisfied?
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but I think one thing that was very concerning to me is the way she legitimized excited delirium. And we had the opportunity to speak with her after her press conference. And that was one of the questions I posed to her, is this has been seen as a junk science. And somehow, Evan, excited delirium, you're only diagnosed with that when a cop kills you. It just happens somehow underneath a cop's hands or a cop's foot, right? You get diagnosed with excited delirium. So I was kind of shocked to hear that not only she presented this as a theory of his death, excited delirium. Now, they went further to say because the officers applied pressure while he was in this state, they contributed to his death. But a question was asked in that meeting we had with her is, isn't excited delirium something the defense should have been bringing an expert on? Isn't that something that would have come up in trial? Why, as a prosecutor, would you actually bring an expert that lifts up excited delirium as an actual valid medical diagnosis? And so that...
What did she say?
I'm assuming... Oh, they said excited delirium, to quote him, excited delirium is a real thing. So they felt they couldn't ignore that this was excited delirium.
the medical examiner, when she got on the stand, you know, this is all sealed, but my understanding is when she got on the stand, she brought up excited delirium. My thought, as a prosecutor, you would bring in one of the many experts who could debunk excited delirium. But instead, they brought in an expert who showed that excited delirium is a real thing. And because of the fact that he didn't have any clothes on, showed that his temperature was elevated. He had all of the signs. So that I'm interested to look at the grand jury minutes to get a better understanding of what happened there and why that expert was put on. But that was just disappointing to hear. They were going, well, you know, I can't say the charge that they presented, but it definitely involves reckless activity or negligence. So I want to believe that Tish James was putting her full heart into this matter. And like Natalie said, until I see the grand jury minutes, I really can't say otherwise. But I will say I thought her recommendations afterwards were weak, and I did tell her that as well. I think we're beyond the place of saying we need de-escalation training. We're beyond the place of talking about when to use force, when to not use force. And we're at the space where we need the courage to develop a new system of public safety. And that's what I shared with her and some of the other activists. We don't want to talk about making police a little bit better. We want to talk about creating something new, Evan. And we need elected officials and people in leadership positions to really champion that we can do it. We can create a different way of responding to social problems than armed men coming into our communities.
Are you following the news out of Ithaca?
I sure am, of course.
I figured you are. Our goal is to get Mayor Svante Myrick on this program to talk about what Ithaca is trying to do, and that's a separate conversation. But let me also just add a little bit more detail to some of what our guest Daniel Ponder is saying about excited delirium. And I will credit the Democrat and Chronicle's Justin Murphy for first pointing out yesterday that the medical expert the attorney general used, his name is Gary Vilke. And that's who Daniel Ponder was just talking about. And he apparently, this is not someone that I've, his career that I have known well, but those who have followed it say that he has worked on dozens, if not hundreds of cases around the country, generally testifying that excited delirium is real and that it should exonerate police officers. So his reputation is that he works on cases to exonerate police in which a person asphyxiates while prone in police custody, and one of the go-tos is, well, excited delirium. And when Daniel Ponder says it's junk science, I would urge listeners to check out Gary Craig's reporting in the Democrat and Chronicle. It is certainly not set in stone that the medical community all views this exactly the same way. And even if there's something very subjective about the idea that, well, anytime you come across somebody who has some drugs in their system, if something goes wrong, well, it's excited delirium. And it becomes a little bit of a fallback is the criticism. Is that fair, Daniel Ponder?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so I would have chose the expert who spoke to the fact that it's actually, you know, how this is used, right? And how it's used by law enforcement. That's the expert I would have thought should be on the stand. Yeah. So I was a little
confused.
I don't understand that part, but I guess the minutes will reveal.
Mm-hmm. Let me get some phone calls. Maria in Rochester. Hi, Maria. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just say something about the sealing of the grand jury's findings. And if we're going to believe the attorney general is genuine about this, then she needs to unseal those. I know that a judge has said she could, but she hasn't yet. Because I think it's the anonymity of the people who make those decisions, those people who are unaccountable, who keep enabling the police to commit murder in communities of color. I mean, if there was ever a situation where somebody says, well, what's systemic racism? This is it. I mean, it does make us feel like there's nothing we can do, right? Because there's no face to it. there's no people. And that needs to stop. When people are going to do this kind of stuff, they need to be accountable to the community. And the other thing I just want to say is that I think the community, the Black Lives Matter community, should be applauded for last night. It is amazing to me that people can, in the face of this kind of violence and frustration, on such a ground. It's amazing to me. And I think that, you know, if anybody breaks anything, everybody's really quick to talk about that. But to think about the behavior of people who are that restrained and take that high a road, I mean, we really need to commend that and to see that idealism and praise it.
Maria, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. And, I mean, I think we know by now. We've seen demonstrations starting in September over the Prude case. I think we know by now that the people online last night, you know, Daniel, I saw people online referring to the crowd, the protest crowd, as rioters. I mean, that's like putting a neon sign on your racism. I mean, there was not a riot.
I was so impressed with them, you know, just to echo what the caller said. You know, Ashley Gantt, Stanley Martin, Iman Abid, so many of the folks who got out last night. I drove around in my car. I was just in tears because I know the sacrifice that all of these folks have given to this movement. You know, physically, being actually physically abused by officers over the summer. And they all have full-time jobs at the same time. And they still were able to rally hundreds of people yesterday after doing it all summer. Like, I have so much love and respect for the women who, and this is mostly a women-led, Black woman-led, femme-led movement that put themselves out there consistently. You know, I saw Ashley go from crying to delivering a just inspiring speech to marching down the highway to, I mean, these are the folks we need to be uplifting in our community. And we know, Evan, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't know who Daniel Prude was. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have gotten the body cam from the 9-year-old girl this recently. If it wasn't for them, there wouldn't be a PIC team. There wouldn't be a Daniel's Law. I mean, these are the folks who are doing the real work in the community. And I just, you know, that's kind of the only thing that's keeping me lifted, is these young women who are really leading this movement.
Natalie, you want to add to that? Are you there? Oh, Natalie might be on mute. We'll see.
It was on mute.
There
Sorry
you go. That's
that,
okay.
I agree completely. I mean, Ashley and Stanley and Iman, they have, I mean, we say blood, sweat, and tears as a saying, but for them and everybody else who has been helping organize these movements, and as Daniel said, it's been a largely woman-led movement, younger woman-led movement. It is blood, sweat, and tears, and it's every single day. Every time you go out into the streets, and as an organizer, they not only are out there, but they also are out there with a giant target on their back from, you know, every possible direction. I was not out there last night because I couldn't. I did not have it. And I admire them so much for not only having it for themselves, but being that beacon of energy for all of those hundreds of people who were out last night and who will continue to come out, the thousands who have continued to come out. It's really a remarkable and impressive organizing job in the middle of really extreme trauma that they're all subjecting themselves to repeatedly.
Let me get Jimmy in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Hi, Evan. Jimmy Highsmith. Hello, Danielle. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, Jimmy. How you doing? Yeah, good.
I want to talk about something that's not subjective, segmentation. So those who don't know, I am a black belt in martial arts, taekwondo and jiu-jitsu, and I've been studying for almost 40 years this spring. And at the end of the day, when they use segmentation, which is something we do in jiu-jitsu, It was done improperly. Had he had his hand on the man's neck and been kneeled, not planking, he would not have put his entire body weight on this man's neck and carotid artery. And I'm upset that no one could see that, that this is what was the primary problem with that call, is the fact that they used segmentation improperly. And as clear as day, you cannot put that kind of pressure on a man's carotid artery or anyone's carotid artery. The same thing happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis. You can't do it. Again, the segmentation is not subjective. It happened for sure, you know, and I'm just appalled that they said they acted within reason, because if you, when you're trained to use segmentation, you do not put your full body weight on one's neck. That's all I have to say, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for the phone call, Jimmy. Natalie, what do you think?
Well, I think that actually raises a really interesting point about not only Danielle Prude, but also the 9-year-old little girl who was recently brutalized by police, in that these are not, you know, wild bank robberies that are dynamic situations where police are making, you know, calls they've never had to, gone on things, done things they've never had to do. And they're just, you know, they're figuring it out, and mistakes happen when you work like that. These were fairly routine calls, family trouble, a child in distress, a man having a mental health issue, a mental health crisis rather. And in these very routine, very pretty controlled situations, at which police drastically outnumbered the civilians who they were supposed to be there to help, this is both times, that's how they behaved. They pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl and forced her face in the snow, and they murdered Danielle Prude. And these were very routine things. When I hear about training and I hear about reform, I'm like, how do police still need training to do what are pretty routine parts of their job without killing people? And then I think about it, and the discussion of segmentation that just happened made it very clear to me. It's that when police only see certain people as worthy of doing their job right for. And most of the time, Black people are not those people. Black people are not worthy of their best efforts, of their most humane efforts, of their kindness. So, I mean, to me, that discussion of segmentation is just so emblematic of the big issue. We cannot train police to see Black people as people, because they just fundamentally do not. It's built into the culture. And there is no way to train that out of them. Because if we could, these budgets would have done it. These budgets are massive. And yet they still are murdering people on routine calls, or brutalizing little children on routine calls. So it's just, it's infuriating.
Yeah, as I send it over to Daniel Ponder, I have to say, Natalie, the point that you're making here is, it really hits pretty hard for me, because for whatever reason, I've not thought about it in the context that you just raised until now, which is that these were pretty routine calls. these were not the I'm not saying the job is simple and every situation is the same. But, you know, the part about the Danielle Prude story that is so difficult, and I've heard from listeners who will defend police on this, and I've heard from retired officers, and I try to listen, and I think the community who knows me know I try to listen and understand. But the notion that just because he might have had PCP in his system, that him, a naked man, disoriented, surrounded by four armed officers in the street, that he was posing such a threat that he had to be handled in that way, what people say to me, well, you don't know what people can be like when they're on drugs. Well, watch the tape.
Yeah.
This was not a man who was threatening those officers. Well, he said, give me your gun. Well, he also said a lot of really disoriented things, too.
Yeah.
I think
it's so obvious.
I think what's clear is that Danielle Prude was naked. Danielle Prude was handcuffed. But Danielle Prude had black skin. And to them, that was the danger. That was a threat. And I think that's basically what Natalie is saying, is that our skin is seen as the weapon, right? And so they see this black man. It doesn't matter that he's handcuffed. It doesn't matter that he's naked. they're still a threat. And actually, if you look through the AG report, there is an area, and I can't remember if this was a witness or an expert, who said that the officers felt that they had to get him under control for officer safety. And once again, Evan, who is in harm when a man is naked and cuffed? There's only one thing to take away from that, is that they found his blackness itself as threatening. And that's the problem. That's the problem with sending police out. Everyone knows you shouldn't pepper spray a 9-year-old girl, Evan. If you did that to your son, you'd be in jail. Mm-hmm. Like, these things are a no-brainer. But when you either devalue blackness or you see a threat and everyone with the black face, then you become aggressive. Then you pepper spray. Then you segment. And so I guess that's why we as the black community, we have to abolish the system as it exists. I can't think of anything else other than acknowledging that giving white men with guns, as I keep saying, giving white men guns and telling them to oversee the black community was an awful idea. And we have to acknowledge, yeah, that was a bad idea. And now we have to figure out a new way of doing things. And it has to be community oriented. It has to be well funded. And it has to be the primary way in which we respond to social problems, because 86% of these crimes are misdemeanors. Misdemeanors. Think of the people who have died, Evan. George Floyd, counterfeit bill, Eric Garner, cigarettes, Walter Scott, a traffic stop. Police should have never responded to any of these calls. Those folks would have been alive today if we had the courage to develop an alternate system.
Well, before I get back to, let's see here, Jay on the phone, Steve and Kathy have sent notes I want to address. On that subject of, an alternative system, Danielle, the mayor, and by the way, my guests include Daniel Ponder and Natalie Ann Knott. Danielle is a musician and attorney. Natalie is an assistant public defender. The mayor and City Hall have touted this plan that is designed to have fewer police respond to calls, to allow a dispatcher to determine, is this a call that requires a police officer? Can we send a specialist, an unarmed specialist? And the mayor is confident that this system, as it rolls out with more resources, will do a better job of handling these calls. She did say, as I understand it, for the people who were wondering, well, why wasn't it done then with the 9-year-old girl who ended up getting pepper sprayed, that, well, they don't really have the resources in place for it yet, but there is a plan to ramp it up. What do you think, Daniel Ponder?
You know, I think it depends on how it rolls out. One thing that I keep hearing about the 9-year-old girl was, well, there was also a call about a stolen vehicle. So because it involved a crime, the team wasn't sent out. So then we have to ask ourselves, what do police do when your vehicle is stolen? They come to your house and write a report. Once again, why do armed men need to write this report, right? So I think if the foundation of it is, oh, but if there's a criminal charge, then we can't come, then that's going to be problematic, because we know mental health issues and crises, they may not present themselves on that initial call, right? Maybe you get a call that it's a petty larceny and you get there and the person is dealing with mental health issues. So I'm a little concerned that we're focusing so much on mental health calls as opposed to focusing on the majority of calls, which are nonviolent minor offenses. And in order to do that, Evan, there's going to have to be some serious shifting of the budget. So her plans are nothing without saying, and we are going to reallocate a significant amount from the policing budget. You can't give the PIC team less than $1 million and give the police $100 million. You just can't do it. So I'm interested to see where it is going forward. But what I see right now is something that is severely underfunded, severely understaffed, and still has this focus on mental health cause. In my understanding, there's only 12 people working on that team.
Okay. Natalie, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to say I think anything that gets police out of the community is a step forward. But I I can't consider myself in allyship with anybody who isn't fighting for the complete eradication of police and also accountability for what for the wrongs that have happened. I recognize that this is an uphill battle. The government as it is has ensconced police not only in legal protections to protect them from suits, but also to make it impossible to regulate the police department, for an outside government to regulate the police department. And I think that any mayor who isn't fighting tooth and nail against these police union contracts to defund the police department at least 50% to start and going down from there is only giving half measure politically motivated half measures. And I don't have a lot of faith in it. As Danielle said, the way a government sets its priorities is funding. And right now, the city of Rochester is not saying that the PIT team is a priority. It's saying that this is a thing we're doing because this happened, instead of this is a thing we need to do to stop that from ever happening again. And that's right. It's frustrating. And it's aggravating because as we discussed before, the issues here are pretty blatant, and thinking that just creating this discrete little team that's only going to come out for a certain type of call is the answer is willful delusion.
Let me get some feedback, a couple of written comments and then some phone calls. So Kathy writes this. Well, actually, let me get Stephen first. He says, the issues he's pointing out that some of the issues that our guests are addressing are being either addressed by government now or being addressed by different proposals. And he says, we're in an election year. Do your guests support Warren or Malik Evans? Do either have a plan comparable to the reforms proposed in Ithaca? And would these attorneys support the Ithaca style proposed reforms? Stephen says, I just want to see extensive change. So, Natalie, I mean, do you want to weigh in on the politics?
I would love to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would love to. I'm a huge admirer of Mayor Myrick. I'm a huge admirer. I think what he's doing
in Ithaca,
Mayor of Ithaca. I think what he's doing is real leadership. He's trying. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what the actual effect is going to be. He has a lot of hurdles to overcome, but I think the leadership and the visionary leadership he's taking here is incredibly impressive. And what we need from our Black leaders, if you are going to ask me for my vote, and part of that ask is going to be me supporting another Black leader, then I need you to stand up and be willing to show visionary leadership, to look at the problems of our time and offer actual solutions, and not just, wallpapering over a bad paint job and hoping that things work out during your term so you don't have to grapple with any of the real issues. So I would support. I do not know what the system is going to look like in Ithaca, so I want to reserve. But I commend Mayor Myrick for leading. I think that is refreshing and necessary, and I hope we see more of it in the upcoming Rochester mayoral race.
Are you implying that the challenger in this race, Councilman Evans, is not offering boldness?
I will say not that I've seen. But I am open to being persuaded.
Okay.
By anybody in that race.
Okay. Daniel Ponder.
I support Stanley Martin, who's running for city council. I support Kim Smith, who's running for city council. Mm-hmm. My mind and my heart will not allow me to support Lovely Warren at all whatsoever. I think of the Prude family. I think about how difficult the fact that Joe Prude's brother was dead. And he had no clue, and he blamed himself, and he thought it was just an overdose. And it wasn't until he got an attorney was he able even to get any more information regarding his brother. And the fact that the city made it difficult, and they prolonged it, and they denied FOIA requests. And even when the mayor found out, if she found out when she said she found out, she still didn't immediately tell the community. I absolutely cannot. My conscience will not allow me to put a vote in that direction, especially since she's been in power for almost 8 years, Evan. almost 8 years, and still one third of this community, the Black community, is living in poverty. And still we have a 9-year-old Taze, a Black man dead, naked in the street, Christopher Pate. Absolutely. I feel like politicians get my vote. My vote is a reward for doing well. And in the past 8 years, I feel that the Black community has been abandoned, not only in economic policy, but in really this this lack of courage when it comes to really tackling the Locust Club, the police contract, and really transforming that system. In regards to Malik needs to step up and say something, because I truly don't believe, I don't know what Malik's plan is. Like Natalie said, I'm open to hear it, but I don't know what his plan is. But I do know this, not to prolong this, this is the city where Frederick Douglass dreamed up a world without slaves, where Susan B. Anthony dreamed up a world where women could have the right to vote, where Kodak dreamed up a world of film. We can be the first people to dream up a world without the police. We can. Every politician I talk to says, well, can you point to an example? Can you show us something else? Someone has to be the first to do it. Maybe it will be Ithaca. But I believe the people in Rochester are progressive enough, innovative enough to be the city that finally says we cannot continue to police the Black community in this way. And so far, nothing that has come from our current politicians has shown me any courage in transforming and really flipping this thing upside down. And I say, what do we have to lose? Let's really think this through.
All right, let me read one more written comment, and then if you're on the phone, we're going to try to get through all the phone calls, so we'll try to keep everything moving here. Kathy just writes and points to a New York Times article in which the Times reported that some of the grand jurors in the Breonna Taylor case, the grand jurors say homicide charges were not even presented. And Kathy is wondering, how do we really know what New York State's Attorney General Tish James tried to accomplish in the Prude case? Without more information, there's a lot of speculation, but in the past, you know, sometimes we see, well, how could the grand jury not do X, Y, or Z? In the case of Breonna Taylor, some of the members told the New York Times, we're not even presented those charges. Danielle, is that a concern?
So, because it's sealed, I know the charges that were presented, but I can't speak on the charges that were presented. And Evan, you know I'm an artist, so I'm also bad at just not at the quorum. But this time I'm going to really try to just shut up and say we will find out what the charges were presented when the minutes are opened.
Okay, so we're going to find out. Okay. Does that work for you too, Natalie?
Need to have a larger discussion as well about the whole grand jury system. I think it's ridiculous that somebody can be charged with a crime in a secret proceeding, and until very recently in New York, defendants never found out what happened in that system. And I think the fact that this was even a question at this time is also ridiculous. So I think there needs to be a larger discussion about the grand jury system in the United States.
All right, to the phones, and we're going to try to keep everything moving because we got a lot to get through. Kevin, first. Go ahead, Kevin.
All right, thank you, Evan. And thank you for this discussion today. I think one of the things to me that was very chilling is just thinking about the fact that if you have a family member that is having a mental health crisis, you're going to think, you know, 2 and 3 times before calling for help. If you think that your family member could be killed. And I think the fact that thought would be split along racial lines, because I think what's really missing is that the lack of humanity. If you think about just even the discussion around they follow a procedure, well, my question is very simple. Any procedure you have that does not have wrapped around it the spirit of humanity, then it is not a procedure for humans. I mean, absolutely. You know, it just drives home the fact that, I'll be honest with you, I am now more convinced than ever, given what happened yesterday, that we need to reimagine and dismantle the structure we call police today and reimagine something that says, if we could start from scratch, what should that look like? And then take a look at the needs. And most of the needs are not violent. Most of the needs are more mental health, drug addiction, all those other type of things. And then we would reimagine a completely different force. And in fact, I would even call it police. I call it something else, just so we can break that cycle of the history that's associated with that. And I tell you, we're not missing in our ability to do this. What we're missing is leadership, courage, and the insight, the ingenuity to say, let's just do this. I am tired, as many people are, and feeling that my life is expendable because I have to be a human being in a black body. And I think it's atrocious. And it should be everybody's business, not just people of color.
Thank you, Kevin. Brief thoughts from Natalie on that first. Go ahead, Natalie.
I think that that's exactly right. We have tried this model. We've tried it for a few hundred years. And the outcomes, even now, with all of the knowledge and all of the technology, and we've had our third or fourth civil rights movement, and we're still here. It's still very, when it comes to policing, it still feels very much like this is still the 1970s. And I agree, and it's time for true visionary leadership to think up another model. It's not that difficult. Other countries do not have the same issues we have with policing. They do not arm their police, and that cuts down on a lot of the violence, and they don't have police that respond to everything. There are other social safety nets that people can turn to for help. And I also think it's really important. He made a really important point about families with people who suffer mental health crisis being unwilling to call the police. What about the people who do need black women who may be in a domestic violence situation? They are far less willing to call the police because of the threat. They don't want to be responsible mm-hmm. for the death of their family member or themselves. This, I mean, we please talk about, oh, we need to be here because we need to respond to violence. We need to help people. But when you repeatedly brutalize and victimize a whole segment of the population and you are completely unaccountable for that brutality, guess what? You are not going to be the people that those people turn to when they need help. So actually, this creates more violence that goes unchecked because the black community does not trust the criminal justice system to fairly represent their interests or protect their lives.
Daniel Ponder.
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about Denise Hawkins, who called the police mm-hmm. because of domestic violence issue and was killed. And that happened mm-hmm. in the 70s. And after she died, there was a commission formed and there were folks getting together to determine how can we reform the police department, right? That was in the 70s. So the question for me is, 10 years from now, do we want to see another black man killed or maybe even less? And do we want to develop another commission and come on this radio show again and talk about the reforms? Is that what we want to do? And do we want to do that every 10 years. If that's what we want to do, fine. Let's just keep talking about implicit bias training and training and training. Evan, if you go back and you read some of the commissioner's reports, you will hear a lot of the same language. We need community-based policing. We need people walking the beat. We need officers really getting to know the neighborhood. And we're talking decades ago. So I can only say, do we want to be here again? Or is this going to be the pivotal moment? And there is something about the energy of this time, right? That the BLM movement is an international movement. There's something about the energy of this time that should propel us into a place that we couldn't even, a place that we never thought of, right? Abolition is something a slave couldn't have fathomed. Leaving with Harriet Tubman is something slaves couldn't have even thought of. What am I going to do? How can my life possibly be? But they knew that freedom was worth it. All of the unanswered questions, it didn't matter because freedom was worth it. And that's how we have to look at policing, not black men not being killed. It's worth it. It's worth trying something new. And that is, to me, people are dying. I can't think of any other profession where you can kill people at this rate. And someone doesn't say, maybe we need to rethink this.
Well, let me try to squeeze in about 30 seconds for Beatrice and Webster. Hi, Beatrice. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Were there any black policemen there with the other policemen when they was surrounding Prude?
When they were surrounded? When
he was laying on the ground and all the policemen were there, was any of them black? Was all the policemen white?
Danielle, Natalie, what was the
they were all white.
I mean,
there was one Latino officer.
That's right. There was one officer who was not white, but that officer was Latino, not black. Okay, so there were no black officers.
Okay, thank you, Evan. Good show, as usual.
Thank you, Beatrice. Nice to hear from you. Thank you for the call. And Danielle just sort of offered her final rallying call. Natalie, do you want to take 30 seconds and offer some final thoughts here? Go ahead.
I think we are coming into a very interesting phase for Rochester, and I think that there is a huge opportunity to, as Danielle said, like reimagine what the world could look like. This could happen in Rochester. It's happened before. It's happened before many times. Danielle cited many examples. I think in a city that is so blessed to have black leadership, we now need brave, visionary black leadership that is ready to actually solve problems and not just put Band-Aids on things to get reelected. We need people who are willing to risk their careers in order to save lives. And I really hope I get to vote for somebody like that soon.
Natalie Annan is an assistant public defender. Welcome back anytime. Natalie, thanks for being
with
us.
Thank you, Evan.
Danielle Ponder, a musician, an attorney, and at the very least, I know we're going to get some killer music out of you soon, but we'll talk about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, let's talk about that soon. Thank you, Danielle. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. Have a good one.
More connections coming up in a moment.